So, hello again, and here we are in Singapore again, and it's a Thursday this time, not a Friday, but we're back with the One Shot Football podcast. Get all your latest football news at www.oneshotfootball.com. We're now as well on Stitcher Radio, so stitcher.com, you can find us there, find the podcast there. I'm your host, Steve McBain, and I've got three special guests with me, two, I would say, regulars now. Mr. Ryan Marsden, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Mr. Rick Overton, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
And making his second appearance of the season, Mr. William Ho. How are you, William?
I'm good.
Good, good. So it's been an interesting week. No Premiership news, but we've had the Euro qualifiers, and what a week it's been. Look at all the minnows that have qualified for the European Championships. Northern Ireland, Wales, Albania, Iceland, and even England. Some great stories, but I think the biggest story is obviously Scotland not qualifying. Well, actually, not maybe Scotland, but the Dutch. I mean, they couldn't even win the must-game win against the Czech Republic. Ryan, what's gone wrong with Holland?
Well, they've got an attitude problem almost similar to Arsenal, don't they?
But they've got a quality problem as well at the moment, right?
What do they? Look at the squad. I mean, I think you look at the depth. I mean, I think it's there. I think the squad's definitely good enough to qualify, and that's really the point we're talking here. They should be quarterfinals at least for the current squad. And so, what is it?
I mean, who went through from their group? I mean, the Czech Republic, Iceland. I mean, a fabulous story. And Turkey have gone through as the best of the third place teams. But I mean, it's a real, for me, the tournament will be a lesser place for not having the Orangi there. But just moving on to the tournament next summer, I was just looking through the list of qualifiers. We don't know the four teams that will come through the playoffs, but guys, any hot tips for who's going to win it?
Well, I personally think that Germany's going to win it. I don't know why. I just think they have the quality, and they always rise to the occasion when it comes to these big events, and I don't really see anyone else stepping in their way. Of course, there could be upsets, but I'm going to go for Germany.
Germany is the best team, for sure, player for player. But in all these big tournaments, there's a lot of things that, you know, unexpected. I mean, if you remember back in, I can't remember the year, Greece won it, right? They were not the best team in the tournament, but they won it.
Denmark, don't forget.
Yes, Denmark was a last-minute inclusion, and they won it.
I'm going to go for an outsider this year, and I'm going to go on statistical averages and law of averages. I'm going to say England have a shout, massive outsider, because I think you got with form, 10 out of 10 is 10 out of 10, undisputed. Law of averages say we've got to do something decent sometime soon. So I'm going to go, because the Dutch are out, it's everyone's going to take points off each other or games off each other in this tournament. I think England might sneak it.
Well, what a surprise. There you have England fans predicting an England victory. I mean, who would have thought it? I think, though, I mean, genuinely, I think it is a very, very open tournament. I think that, you know, Spain have recovered, I think, you know, from their disaster at the World Cup. I mean, just looking down the list, I think France are not a bad team. Belgium, they can't be dark horses because everyone's tipping them, but there isn't really an outstanding team, so hopefully we'll at least get a decent tournament. Now,
your prediction?
My prediction.
Scotland. Oh, sorry, they're not in it.
Well, I'm going to go law of averages as well, because I tip Italy every time, and they've been absolutely pants. So I'm going to go with Italy yet again. I just like the blue shirts. Now, the price of football in the UK survey has just been revealed. It's the biggest study in Europe. It's very, very comprehensive. And it looks like ticket prices have, on the whole, I think 50% of ticket prices have stayed the same. I think it was 18% have gone down, and about 31% have gone up. So I don't know whether this is, you know, some benefit from the new TV deal finally, you know, flowing down, or maybe football's just finally reached the point where it prices itself out of the market. I mean, I'm going to be at Stamford Bridge on Saturday. I don't think my day is going to get any cheaper, but we will see how that goes. And Sam Allardyce, I mean, very convenient to get the job at Sunderland at the same week as his book comes out. He's been getting stuck into West Ham fans royally this week, saying that they're delusional, that he doesn't know what the West Ham way is. I mean, Rick, any idea what the West Ham way is, or...?
Well, I just think that with Sam Allardyce coming to Sunderland, I think it's a good move for Sunderland, per se. You know,
but rumour is his first sign is going to be Kevin Nolan again. I mean, what signal is this sending out?
Well, managers have their favourites, and, you know, They have.
But I mean, Kevin Nolan's old. Oh, he's older than you, Rick. I mean, come on.
I'm not sure about that, actually. Might play a little bit of football than me, but you know, I don't know. I just think Sunderland bringing Sam Allison is going to bring stability. He's obviously, you know, quite good with their relegation or promotion from into Premier Leagues with the West Ham and Bolton. But the one thing that's sort of working against him, and he's an ex Newcastle coach, and you know, now he's sort of like. You know, switching sides and now managing Sunderland. Maybe some repercussions
but
there.
Well, presumably the Sunderland fans will love him because he was so despised by the Newcastle fans. But he's been getting stuck into Benitez as well. And Ryan, I mean, some cracking quotes about Wenger. I mean, do you have any issue with Allardyce's quotes? Or?
No, Sam Allardyce, for me, is one of the most underrated managers on the
Not planet. By himself.
Not that's true. And good on him, he's got a big head relative to everything else, and the ego is obviously relative to the head. But he's a good manager. He's performed well. You know, look what he did at Bolton. That's obviously well known, but people underestimate what he did at Blackpool. I even think more recently West Ham, severely underrated what he performed, how he performed there. He's got unceremoniously booted a couple of times when it really wasn't expected. He's clearly very polarizing. But for me, you know, his comments, every comment he made. Forget recent comments, any comments, they're always just from the heart. He's just
a plain speaking northerner.
Like what I say what I like. That's it.
So, William, I mean, I would venture this might be his toughest task yet. Can he keep the Black Cats up?
I think so. He's one of those managers that is a bit like Pulis, and is a bit like, you know, who's never going to bring them up to the level of the top four. At the same time, they'll get a Black Cat safe.
I agree. For me, he's the best man for the job. We talked about it last week. Definitely the best man for the job. Sunderland actually don't have a bad squad. They need motivating. They need a bit more discipline. That's exactly what Allardyce will bring. You know, who did they buy from City? There was Johnson, the younger kid. The City bought Brampton. Can't remember his name.
Rodwell.
Rodwell, right. I mean, these are good backbone people.
First thing you should do is just sell Borini. It's useless.
They just bought him. Now, on buying and selling players, David De Gea has been refusing to answer any questions this week and directing everyone to his agent, Jorge Mendes. It looks like there's a release clause in his new contract at Manchester United. I mean, Ryan's probably not a surprise. I mean, they're talking about maybe £30 million and he could be off to Real.
The only surprise to me is that it's that little. I mean, you talk about a player who was about to be bought for £28 million. In his last year, by default, if he's on a 5-year contract, that has to be, the release clause has to be more than that. Or maybe it was conditional for him signing a 5-year contract to make such a low release clause. There's lots of shenanigans there. As a United fan, I'm delighted that he signed the contract. It was a great twist, a very, very interesting sequence of events. Maybe this is the old compromise, but yeah, it is what it is. If he performs well this season, he will stay.
I don't like giving credit to Manchester United ever, but I do actually think they've played this one quite well, and I think Real Madrid have done terribly here. I think that, you know, they've made things so hard for themselves. They've got a pretty poor keeper themselves by their own standards. Mm. And, you know, United, well, you know, they've got a player who looks content again, and, you know, they'll get a transfer fee at the end of it.
Sorry to go back on this, but Real had all summer to buy this player. United didn't want to sell him all summer. Blame has been apportioned either way, but no question, Real Madrid, ball is in your court, buy the player. Don't leave it to the last minute.
But this is typically the way they've done this. They do this long courting procedure. I think they feel it unsettles the player, makes their position untenable. They did it with Bale. I remember it was quite a long, drawn-out procedure with Figo and Zidane. It does seem to be their way, but this one has come back to bite them, it would seem. Now, also during the international break, there's been quite a few injuries to big players. Chelsea fans are dancing in the streets because Branislav Ivanovic is going to be out with a hamstring injury. I would suggest that is a blessing in disguise. I mean, Chelsea probably now going to go on and win the league, I would suggest. But on a more serious note, I mean, Tim Krul at Newcastle, he's, I think, basically out for the season. We've also seen injuries to Benzema, Morata and Pogba from Juventus, and Nemanja Matic. I mean, the associations have to pay the wages for the players during the time injured once it goes beyond 28 days. I mean, guys, do we think it's is that fair, and do we believe that the international associations look after the players properly?
I think it's totally unfair for the association to have to pay for all this. End of the day, the players play for the pride of their country. If they get injured, you know, they can choose not to play. They can choose to opt out before the game and say that they have some niggling ankle injury, but you know, they play because they want to play for the country.
But they,
they have a full-time contract with their clubs.
Well, then I guess if the associations don't play, what I would then say is that the clubs don't have to be. You, if you're saying it's the player's choice, and if he's injured playing football for somebody else other than the club, then for the time he's injured, then the club shouldn't have to pay and they receive no wages. I don't see how the clubs can be penalised for a player being injured on international duty.
There has to be compensation. I mean, that's what it is. You know, they're looked after. Things happen, accidents happen. They'll be insured. I mean, if we bring it down to money, they'll be insured.
But at the same time, I mean, you know, if you have, you know, Ronaldo or Messi, you know, whatever, a player that's, you know, basically irreplaceable, the insurance money isn't going to replace that player in terms of performance, lost points. I mean, for Newcastle, I mean,
except,
you know,
one club, Newcastle, because that chairman, all he cares about is extracting money from that club.
But Tim Krul could be the difference between them staying up and going down.
I think he will be the difference. He's a fantastic keeper.
It's a tricky one. But the other thing that everyone's going to be looking at this weekend, and we've had a week to digest the news, is Jurgen Klopp. Now, plenty of sound bites. I mean, he said all the right things. He uses some colourful language. I mean, he's a very colourful character. He says the group of players he has is excellent. I mean, what can we expect from him?
Well, one thing that he's got for his advantage is he's a very young manager. He's only 48 years old. I think that plays to his advantage. And he's got a proven track record with his success at, well, most particularly at Borussia Dortmund. And I expect big things from him. I really wanted Manchester United to sign him ahead of Louis van Gaal, but personally, because I think what he brings to the game is a little bit different. He's already spoken against his possession football, which personally I'm starting to hate. And and he's really big on his training on fitness and speed, which, you know, just brings more excitement to the game. I think he's a great person to run Liverpool, and I think he's going to do very well.
I mean, I'm not quite sure. I mean, people are saying this is the most important managerial appointment in England since Arsene Wenger in terms of revolutionising things. I mean, it seems to me like the press, you know, just has to try and hang the hat on something. I mean, I agree it's quite an exciting appointment, but there's nothing really to suggest that, you know, he's going to be an instant success. And I mean, do we agree with him when he says that the group of players at Liverpool is excellent?
I think so. I mean, if you look at the players that you know, Coutinho, you have Milner, you have Sturridge. These are good players.
Yeah, you also have Milner, Henderson, Sarko. I'm not sure Lallana, by what standards you would describe them as excellent.
There's a backbone there, and I think any new manager needs a backbone to build upon, and that's what he's got. And a test of his management will be to extract the best of the players he has and improve it when he can, i.e. the transfer windows, January and in the summer.
I mean, it's quite interesting. I mean, he's taken Liverpool at a time when, you know, Sturridge is just coming back in. I just wonder whether if Sturridge gets back amongst the goals, that could make the difference. But, you know, would that not have made the difference for Rodgers as well?
Well, Sturridge could be back for like two games and then he's going to be injured again. But I think the main difference is there was so much speculation about Brendan Rodgers, and I think it was really affecting the players. And now you've got a new guy coming in. For the next few games, I can see that the Liverpool players will get a lift from it, and that will just kickstart the season.
Well, there is. I mean, there's always this sort of new manager lift and, you know, the short-term effect, but whether that's enough to, you know, to sort of last long term with Liverpool, I'm not sure. I mean, guys, do we think they can make the top four this year? I mean, obviously Chelsea are looking a bit iffy.
I don't think they're going to make the top four. I think Jurgen Klopp's going to, he's seen the right things. You know, I've got a great squad, but I think he's more of a long time placement, and over time he's going to change that team and change the tactics from what Brendan Rodgers had. I think it's going to take more than a year to do.
Well, Brendan Rodgers changed his own tactics, I think, every 60 well, minutes or something, but
precisely. So I think Jurgen Klopp will take him a good year, to change his team, to transform a team, to bring in the players he wants to bring in. And no, there's no way they can make top four this year.
I reckon he's going to buy at least 3 German players before the end of the season.
But he specifically said that he's not going to buy any players from Dortmund. He's been very, very categorical.
Sure, yeah, other German players from not Dortmund.
Okay, all right. Well, we will see, and we'll be discussing his debut at White Hart Lane tomorrow. So that takes us to the end of part one, and we'll be back with part two. So here we are back with part two of the One Shot Football podcast. So you can get all your latest football news and views at www.oneshotfootball.com. Now, in part two, we usually have a bit of a roundtable discussion, and this week, what we really wanted to talk about is are Asian players and their profile within the world game. I mean, here in Asia, I mean, the coverage of European football, in particular the Premiership, is just huge. I mean, there's just saturation coverage. You can watch more Premiership games here than anywhere else in the world. Now, this is also at a time where, if you look at the Asian confederations, you've had Japan and Korea in particular doing pretty well at the World Cups. China's been a little bit sort of hit and miss, but also the Middle East, which falls under the Asian Confederation as well, have got some good teams, some good players, steady representation in the World Cup. Southeast Asia is a little bit different. I think, William will discuss this a little bit more at length. I mean, football in Southeast Asia is not really taking off in the way that I think we hope. It just doesn't seem to quite have the quality despite having the interest. But as I say, despite lots of teams within Asia having seemingly good players, good representation at the World Cup, they do seem to be underrepresented in the European leagues. Is it? I mean, what are we thinking here? The players not seem to be good enough, or what do we think the issue might be?
I think the mindset is the biggest difference in European countries when you want to be a professional footballer. You start from a very young age that you are determined to become a professional footballer, and that's what you gear for 100%. Whereas in, especially in Southeast Asia and especially in Singapore, sports is not something that you will come to your mind when you say that this is my career, because there's just not enough money in it. I'm speaking from experience, because when I was playing semi-professional football, I played because of passion, not because of the money. And it comes to a point of time you make a decision whether do you want to concentrate on studies or career or choose sports as a career. Don't get me wrong, it's become better through the years, but we are still way, way behind in terms of infrastructure for the youth going forward to professionals. And yeah, the support is just not there.
Just working on this sort of point from a socioeconomic level, I mean, there's obviously been a huge influx of South American players for the longest time into Europe and more so into the Premier League now. I think typically South American players were seen as not particularly able to integrate into the English league. But I think, everything is so global now, that's very much, not the case. And obviously a lot of African players have come over. Now, I guess that there's been an economic reason for people to go to Europe. I mean, obviously the salaries, the wages and things are typically higher. But if you look, for instance, in Asia and where the powerhouses of football are, Japan and Korea, I mean, these guys are getting paid pretty well in the Korean League, in the J League. I mean, is it a sort of almost like European arrogance that we just expect that people want to come to Europe because that's where it is? Whereas, they're actually playing in full stadiums in Japan. I mean, I don't know if you've watched any Japanese football on TV. I mean, great atmospheres, the standard seems quite high. I mean, are we doing these guys a disservice by just insisting that they have to come to Europe?
I think it works two ways. I mean, you've got your European selection process that's been embedded for 20, 30 years, and by default, an Asian player is going to struggle to fit into that. But, let's not be naive. These guys are superstars in their home town, in their home country. And there's a comfort zone, there's a cultural comfort zone. It's no right or wrong, it's just a cultural comfort zone.
Because, I mean, if you take, for instance, Australia, which I would say is a nation that's probably lagged Japan and Korea in terms of quality and numbers that are playing the game. It's still a relatively small country population-wise. But there's a lot of Australian players who've come over and made the grade in in England, so it's...
But that cultural divide is not so great.
Well, obviously, I mean,
you know, so I guess my point is, you know, Korea, Japan, you know, there are high-quality players. There are obviously high-profile Korean and Japan players who are playing in Europe, but very rare. They are definitely heroes in their town, in their club, as you say. They play in the stadiums. They're celebrities. Why would they sacrifice that, the language, every barrier is there? It takes a very special type of person to be able to transcend that, and that's not an easy thing to do. So I think it's cultural on both sides. It's a very interesting question because there's no doubt about the talent that exists. The effort, you know, Jisung Park at Man United never stopped running.
I mean, you know, you go back 10, 15 years ago and you think about Nakata. I mean, the quality of that guy is one of my favourite players.
I mean, amazing.
He's a wonderful player, and he was a real pioneer. I mean, I think it was Roma he played most of his career at before ending up with Sam Allardyce at Bolton.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like you say, there's definitely the quality there. I mean, you know, it shows in the World Cup, and it's not just, you know, hard running and, you know, endeavour. I mean, there's some real technical ability there.
But it's as players, it's agents, because agents dictate moves.
I agree with what Ryan is saying. I know Steve will not like it when I'm going to talk about women's football. You remember not too long ago, Japan won the Women's World Cup.
No idea.
Right? And how many Japanese female players are playing in the European League?
I was actually quite happy about Japan winning because they knocked out England. So it was.
But you think about it, seriously.
No, and it was actually an own goal by one of the English players. It was terrible.
So technically, this Japanese women players are fantastic, right? Technically. And then they're good players, they run hard, and, you know. But how many of them are actually playing in the European League, where there's a proper women's league? Likewise in Japan, but.
But I mean, if you think about it now, I mean, for the development of Asia, I mean, there is this intrinsic European attitude that if you're going to be a success at football, you have to come to Europe. I mean, it's like if you're a boxer, you have to go to America. But
it's,
I mean,
it's all TV. About TV.
But if you look at the relative strength now and the infrastructure, so we've mentioned Korea, Japan, and Australia. I mean, China is starting to pay some big wages and things. I mean, for Asia to develop and for, you know, to get a team together that could possibly win a World Cup, I mean, what do we think is the best thing for them? Is it to continue to try and migrate to Europe and learn the methods there, or develop their own leagues and coaching? I mean, Asia's huge,
it's
right?
It doesn't start at an early age. As William said, it doesn't start early enough. You know, we're from the UK. We don't realise it, but you kick a ball at the earliest age you can. And even playground standards at the age of 7 are actually quite high. It's a daft thing to say, but that's the truth. If people have even kicked a ball at the age of 7, you know, you're already so far behind from what are we going to do as a youth. First thing you do in Europe, I'm not going to say UK, but Europe, is get your kid into a football team, local one, in the hope that they'll be spotted, whatever the reason. Doesn't happen here. Maybe there are spotters here, but it's not a lucrative career choice, and it's so embedded, it's so fundamental. That's what needs to shift.
I mean, William, I mean, we touched on Southeast Asia. I mean, I think, you know, Singapore is a specific, you know, little problem in terms of, you know, attitudes towards sport and professional sport. But, you know, for the likes of Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, even Vietnam, where, you know, there are big crowds and, you know, passionate crowds and, you know, a lot of people play. What do they need to do to try and bridge this quality gap?
Singapore is a very unique situation. I mean, Fandi Ahmad, Singapore's favorite football son, basically say that 70 to 75% of the population of Singapore are Chinese. How many Chinese can you find in a national team? One. So it's a mindset.
Singapore-specific problem. I mean, you know, if you look at Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia, which obviously far bigger population base, far more potential. What's the issue there? How do they get to Japan or Korea's level?
I think it's economic reason as well. I mean, people are more worried about making a living than, you know, proper living. Then again, it comes back to what I said, there's just not enough money in sports in all these countries.
Okay, but at the same time, I mean, Africa, we've had some great teams from the Ivory Coast, Cameroon, Ghana, we've seen some, you know, some fabulous, I mean, these are not countries that people would associate with, you know, high GDPs or whatever, but yet they've turned out.
It will be very interesting to see how much money the government and the corporate companies actually put into football in Africa compared to likewise in Southeast Asia. I would say there will be a lot of difference. As in, basically, you know, how much money is the Singapore government or Malaysian government or the Malaysia public companies putting into?
But I mean, you know, if you look at the Malaysian leagues, I mean, these guys are getting 30,000-40,000, you know, every game. I mean, you know, if you go to an Indonesia-Thailand game or Indonesia-Malaysia, I mean, there's big, passionate crowds. There's a huge amount of interest.
Maybe the FA isn't as organized. It's clearly not going to be as organized as a European country where that money flows back into grassroots. There's no doubt that the revenue is there in local leagues, when I say local, but Asian leagues. But really, has there been any analysis of where that money goes? Does it go back to grassroots? Because that's what you need. You need to start that generational change. Maybe that money just goes into the pockets of the chairman of the clubs and the FAs. I mean, it's a bit controversial, but you need that. There has to be that cash injection, that change of attitude. Maybe that's what's stopping the obvious flow.
I mean, even within the UK, I mean, there's been a lot of debate and soul searching about why there are so few what you would call British Asian players playing. My own take on it was that it's probably because the greater part of people who have migrated to the UK are from what you would class as the Indian subcontinent, and football just, you know, isn't that big in India, Pakistan, these places. I mean, cricket is the main thing, but it just feels to me just really disappointing that when you turn on the TV and you watch any of the big European leagues, that there just isn't a bigger Asian representation, especially given the viewing figures and the passion of the people out here. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the fans in the UK grump and, you know, moan about, you know, the amount of, you know, tourists and things are at games, but they don't realise just how passionate people are here about football. I mean, you know, you take yourself, William, I mean, how many nights have you, you know, turned on the TV at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch Spurs get beat again? But, you know, been up till like 5 in the morning. I mean, I know the Chelsea Supporters Club here. I mean, these guys meet, you know, in a bar every single game. I mean, it doesn't matter what time it kicks off, they are there for absolutely everything. I mean, it really is dedication. And I'd just like to see some more representation on the pitch. But I guess, you know, it's something that will take time and no obvious answers, I guess. I mean, anything they can do in the short term, William, do you think? Or
no. I honestly think it's a structural issue and...
That's it. It's down to the FAs. Right? Yeah. It's down to the local FAs, you know. Get these players back. So if you're from Korea, get the Korean success stories back. Do a marketing exercise for years. Get them into schools. Get them into playgrounds. These guys are heroes. It's not like they're ignored in their home country. They are heroes. They are idolized. The local FAs need to put more into that and make the change. I think it has to start. That's their obligation. You're a football association. That's your primary role is to encourage it.
But I think as well, I mean, maybe you could turn this on its head. I mean, for instance, we're all sitting here, you know, we live in Asia. I mean, William, you know, you're from Singapore. I mean, how much Asian Champions League, Asian Cup, Japanese, Korean or Australian football do you watch?
To be honest, I've been watching more compared to maybe, say, 5-6 years ago. But in relative to what I'm watching the rest of the world, is hardly anything.
I mean, I've watched a couple of the Asian Champions League games, and the quality is actually not bad. I mean, there seems to be a bit of a gap, I think, between what you would call the Western Asian teams, the teams from the Middle East, and, you know, and then you've got the Japanese, Korean, and some of the Chinese teams versus, you know, Southeast Asia. But there's some good sides in there. I mean, you know, there's a couple of the Kuwaiti teams, I think, are pretty good, and you know Guangzhou, obviously they had Lippi. And then Cannavaro went in there. They put a coaching structure in. I think when Lippi came, he brought in something like 25 coaches. When he left, only 5 of them left. So, you know, they've got a really good, you know, coaching structure, you know, in place now. I mean, I think, you know, half of it is that, you know, everyone just keeps looking at you know, at Europe for, you know, to take the lead, whereas maybe the answer is to really try and promote, you know, within the region. And, you know, okay, maybe you need to borrow some of the, you know, the coaching methods and, you know, import some of that, but maybe that's the way forward. I don't know.
Football's football. Every kid loves to, well, not every kid, but most kids love to play football, and you'll always get an element of that cross-section who want to succeed and are good enough to succeed. It's just that that particular element isn't being, doesn't have the infrastructure to really make it to the next level. That's what needs to change. But I think there is the passion, the determination to do it, just needs to happen. And it, but these things take time.
Well, there you go. I think that's some great sentiment from Ryan to round off part two. So, as I say, that will take us to the end of part two, and we'll be back with a preview of the weekend in part three. Okay, so so here we are back with part three of the One Shot Football podcast, and we're going to preview some of the big games this weekend. So, William, the early kickoff, Spurs versus Liverpool. You've got Jurgen Klopp, but Kane's back amongst the goals, scored a goal for England during the week. Is he going to get back amongst them? Are you going to win this game, or what's going to happen?
Come on, you Spurs! I think it's going to be a close game. I think the biggest difference is that the Liverpool players will have a lift, like mentioned earlier on about the new manager. But Spurs are playing well.
And Spurs seem to be like they're improving at the moment, yeah?
Oh, I mean, we definitely are improving. You know, we haven't lost for ages since the first game of the season. And I think we're going to continue with them. We're going to continue to find form. I think...
Find form?
Yeah.
Tottenham, apart from Villa, are the most disappointing, worst team.
They're unbeaten in seven, and they've won three of the last four.
Yes.
Better than Manchester United's form.
Okay. Who's on top?
Manchester City, but...
No, who's on top of who? Manchester on top of Spurs, or Spurs on top of Manchester?
Well, we're talking about Spurs.
We're talking about Spurs Liverpool here. I mean, we are probably expecting, you know, something from Klopp. I mean, Liverpool's form. I mean, the last five games, two draws, a solitary win, and two losses. I mean, I guess we shouldn't be expecting too much from Klopp in his first game. I mean, the players have been away on an international break. I mean, I wouldn't think he's going to try and, you know, attempt any radical surgery. I mean, I think if Sturridge is fit, then that's a big fillip. I mean,
I think Klopp's not going to do anything dramatic. It's just going to be taking a look. But I think, like William said, I think the players will react to the new manager coming in, and they will definitely come out trying to impress, especially those ones that haven't been impressing too much this year. It's now that I've second.
But that's not really narrowing it down, is it? I mean,
no, it's not. But I sort of agree with Ryan too that Spurs are okay, they get the results, but I don't think they're on top form. I think it's going to be a tie.
That's in European language, that's a draw. Apologise for our North American friend.
I think Spurs 2-0 and Kane will score.
I think everyone's expecting fireworks. I'm managing my expectations. It's going to rain on those fireworks, and there won't be any that go off. It's going to be 0-0, and everyone's going to go, what is going on?
Well, I don't know. I fancy Liverpool to sneak this one. We'll certainly see. But now, Chelsea Villa. Now, tomorrow morning, I'm getting on a plane from Singapore to London, so I will be there. But the problem is, I have a horrible feeling that if Chelsea don't get a win, that I might be watching Jose's last game in charge. I mean, Villa are probably the only team in the league who've been worse than Chelsea this season. This should be a nailed on 3 points for Chelsea, shouldn't it, guys?
Should be, absolutely. And I think even if they lose, I don't think it's Mourinho's last game. He's too much quality, and he's going through a rough
patch. But you can't have, I mean, look, I do not want Mourinho to go at all. I absolutely idolise the guy. But you can't have Chelsea in 16th place.
No, you can't. And I'm fairly confident that they'll win this game. But I can't see how they won't. They've got to bounce back. There's too much quality on the team. This, you know, the pressure's on. I think they're going to respond positively. I think it's a Chelsea.
I mean, Villa have lost the last four and six of the last seven. I mean, that's pretty poor.
I'll tell you something. This is Chelsea's most difficult game of the season. Aston Villa, you know my opinions, are by far and away the worst club. That's pressure. They have to perform.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, they'd almost be better playing Manchester United and having. Correct. I mean, because look, I mean, the one game they won was against Arsenal, right? They raised themselves and
Chelsea should win this 3-0.
The difference is,
but it's the biggest pressure game they've probably had for some time. I agree with Rick. I don't think it's Mourinho's last game. Even if they lose, I don't think there's a better man for the job anywhere close. And it's still early. The table's quite close. 3 wins in a row gets you back into, you know, top 5, top 6, but it's a big game, it's a big pressure game, very interesting. I even might watch it.
I agree with you that it's a must win game for Villa, but can they do it? Must win and able to win is a separate thing. I think this could be Tim Sherwood's last game.
Villa won't win it, Chelsea might lose it. That's the difference in this one.
Alright, so predictions, guys?
Rick? Chelsea win 2-0.
Form is temporary, class is permanent, 3-0 Chelsea.
I reckon this could be 4-0 Chelsea.
Well, I hope you're right, boys, and I do tend to agree. I don't want to jinx it, but I do see a Chelsea win. Now, Palace, West Ham, London derby. I actually think this might be a pretty good game. I mean, two teams who've been playing pretty well. Both seem to be better suited to play, you know, to playing away from home. I mean, a lot's made of the atmosphere at Selhurst Park and things, but the results have been pretty patchy at home. Guys, what are we thinking here?
I think it's going to be a great game. I think Palace at home, I think they play superb at home. West Ham's obviously had a great run of a great run away from home, and they both play exciting football. I'm looking forward to watching this one. Who's going to win in the outcome? It's going to be a tough one. I have to go with a tie, 2-2 though. 2-2 or 3-3.
That's a draw. 2-2 draw, is it, Rick?
Another draw. Sorry.
So no one will come in with a go-ahead score, right? It'll be a.
Will it be a reverse in this picture?
It's going to be a draw.
So there you go, 2-2 draw. Rick's only predicting 4 touchdowns in the whole game. Now, Ryan, what are you thinking here?
Yeah, two great teams to watch. Palace, very attacking. And West Ham have surprised me. Palace haven't surprised me. Their position is fantastic. They deserve to be there. West Ham have surprised me this season. I thought they might falter, but you know, hats off. They've done a good job. I think you're going to have an open game, lots of chances. The atmosphere is going to be incredible down there. I think it's going to be something like a 4-3 to Palace. It's going to be that sort of game.
Yeah, I reckon Palace is going to nick this one, although I think that both teams have overachieved, really, in terms of the standings in the table. I reckon 2-1 Palace.
I'm going to rain on the parade and go for a 0-0. But I think this will be a good game. But part two, we were discussing Asian footballers in depth. Rick, you had a little snippet off air?
Yeah, well, when I got a topic, I decided to look up Southeast Asian players, top Southeast Asian players playing in Europe. And 10 came up. And I didn't know any of them besides one.
So you just had to modify your usual web search a little bit, yeah?
No. No, well, anyway, the trump card is Johan Cabaye is French international. However, his grandmother is Vietnamese.
Well, there you go.
So I've got to raise this. If his grandmother's Vietnamese, that makes him valid to play for Vietnam, correct? Who in their right mind would choose France to play for when you can play for another country?
I completely agree.
He should be Vietnam's top player.
There you go.
Look at the lack of disappointments in his career compared to what they currently are.
Arsene Wenger and France's biggest fan, Ryan Marsden. Now then, Ryan, moving on to Everton versus Manchester United. And I put it to you that the Emperor has no clothes. We're back to the bad old days with Van Gaal. We've got midfielders up front, we've got defenders in goal, we've got strikers on the bench. I mean, what's going to go on here?
This is a true test for Van Gaal. True test.
I think so too.
You come off the back of what is one of the most disappointing results last time out in the Premier League.
And disappointing performances as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can against Wenger, you can motivate yourself any which way you want. You know, beat the man, beat the team, both, right? But to lose 3-0, rolling over, that doesn't work. If you can't motivate your team, and we all know they can win this fixture, if you can't motivate your team, that's a big signal for me. Man United certainly have the ability to do it. Everton are performing well and have been a little bit of a bogey side, not a little bit, quite a lot, in the last two seasons. I am nervous about this one. I'm going to say a draw. I still think United have the capability, if motivated, and that's why it's a test on Van Gaal. If motivated, United can win this comfortably, but I'm probably going to go with a draw. And that's how it stands. 1-1.
I'm going to go for 1-0 Everton. Naismith is going to score.
There you go. The hipster choice, I think, from William. Rick?
Yeah, I wish we were playing someone else. Everton's on really good form.
Well, not that great when you look at it. I mean, they've only won 2 of their last 5 and 3 out of 8. I mean, it's not...
But their quality of football they're playing is you know, is probably playing better than the quality the United's playing at the moment.
Everton haven't lost a match for some time, and that's the consistency that worries me.
Well, I just can't be done with Roberto Martinez. That's the problem. But
it's going to be a massive test for Man U, and, you know, this is Louis van Gaal on the line, and if he doesn't get a result, you know, I think we should start asking questions of him, because he can't keep blaming the players all the time. At some point, he's going to...
But you're only 2 points off the top. I mean...
We're 2 points off the top, but we've had a fairly easy schedule, and as soon as we played some quality team with Arsenal last time, they really exposed us.
I mean, definitely away form seems to be the problem. I mean, you lost at Arsenal, you lost at Swansea. I mean, you know, you would argue that Everton are another sort of footballing team. You've lost to two teams with, you know, with a lot of mobility.
And Everton's another team that we don't really play well against historically. I mean, hopefully this would be a good time for Rooney to pick up his game and show some more.
I think any time in the last 4 years would have a good time for him to pick up his game.
That's true. I mean, he's not been on top form, well, 4 years is a bit harsh, but particularly this year. But I don't know. I'm going to go with a draw.
Tactical nous wins this game. Motivation wins this game. But if both teams have cause to raise their game, if United can't do it, we shouldn't be contenders.
Well, believe it or not, I think United are going to win this. I'm going to take them to win this 2-1. But okay. We shall see. Now Newcastle-Norwich, the Sunday game. I mean, it's not probably one for the purists, but I think this could be a really, really interesting game, because Norwich have got a chance to actually get themselves into mid-table. I think they're going to have a long, hard winter because they've got a small squad. But they can open up a bit of a gap to the likes of Newcastle if they could win. I mean, that would take them... They're 6 points ahead of Sunderland and Newcastle at the moment. This would take them 9 points ahead of Newcastle if they could win. I mean, Norwich have looked better on the road. They've not had a lot of luck, but at the same time, I don't think luck keeps you up. And I think you sort of make your own luck to an extent. Newcastle, I mean, they're down and out, right? I mean, they got thumped by Manchester City. They've lost their goalkeeper. They're not scoring goals. I mean, in a lot of ways, this is a big opportunity for them, but is it one that we think they can take?
Well, to start off, I'd really rather watch the rugby than watch this one.
That's why we got you here and why we're paying you so much money, William.
Exactly. But, you know, Newcastle is just horrible. Just horrible team to watch, and I think Norwich is playing a better football, and if you ask me, I think Norwich is going to nick this one and McLaren is on his own way out.
I'd like Norwich to win. I mean, I'm a big Alex Neil fan. I think that the Premiership needs one of these Glaswegians who just looks like you could just take your head off just by looking at you, and he's sort of got that about him. You know, I think there's a lot of the young Ferguson in Alex Neil. I really do. But I mean, they don't have a lot of quality in that squad. These are the kind of games that they, you know, they need to win. They, you know, they gave up 3 points against West Ham, you know, towards the end and things. They need to start converting some of their good play into points. I mean, Ryan, what do you think here?
I'm going to go back to basics on this one. Newcastle have struggled to score goals. End of story. They've virtually scored.
The young guy up front, though, he's a handful. What's his name? Is it Mitrovic or...? The other one. The big guy that got sent off.
Serbian, right?
Yes.
He's a big unit. But I mean, like you say, they're not scoring goals.
They've scored 6 goals all season, right? Goals win games. Cliche. Norwich will not be shy of scoring goals. These are the games where this is, again, motivation, psychology. Neil, the manager, is going to say, right, we're at St James's Park, whatever it's now currently called, but let's call it St James's Park. This is a game when I was going to go there, show them what you can do. And Norwich can score goals. They're very fluid. They've got a nice wide style of play, and they will score goals. And I think it will come down to that. And they will score more goals than Newcastle, and especially without Krullingall, who has saved them on a number of occasions. I actually think Norwich will snake this.
Okay, so you're going for an away win, Rick?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Ryan on that, because I just think that Tim Krul is going to be a big loss for Newcastle. I think they, you know, any strength they've shown this year has been on the defense, and it's been led by Tim Krul and the defense, and obviously they're very weak at scoring goals, and Norwich is just going to rip them open. I think they're going to go Norwich win 2-0.
William, what was your final prediction?
Well, Norwich is going to nick this 1-0.
You know what I want from this game is rain, because I want to see if Steve McLaren is going to bring his umbrella.
I don't think he even possesses one anymore. So. I'm not sure about this one. I'm going to go with a draw here. I'm not quite sure what to think. Anyway, okay, so these were the games that we were going to cover. So we're going to round things off as usual with our weekly quiz. So trying to be as topical as we can this week. So who said it? Jurgen Klopp or Brendan Rodgers? Yes, it's true. I underwent a hair transplant. I think the results are really cool. Don't you?
Is that translated or was that originally in German?
Klopp or Rodgers?
Klopp.
Klopp. Klopp.
Rodgers.
Klopp it is. Every player I see is my own son.
Klopp.
Klopp.
I go Rodgers.
Rodgers it is. This was actually in the Liverpool program he did at the start, the one with the envelopes and all that. Now, I've always said that you can live without water for many days, but you can't live for a second without hope. Wow, I mean, that's just the kind of stuff that gets you going.
That's definitely Rodgers.
Klopp.
Klopp.
Rodgers it is. Now, you train dogs. I like to educate players.
That's German. That's Klopp.
I think I'm Rodgers.
You're Rodgers.
It's Rodgers again. Absolutely brilliant.
It's quite a philosopher, isn't it?
It is. Now, the last one. My biggest mentor is myself, because I've had to study. So that's been my biggest influence.
Oh, that's Klopp for sure.
Guys?
Klopp.
Well, I have to go for Rodgers, I guess.
It's Rodgers again. Isn't he?
What a philosopher.
He should actually Jeez. Just... Oh. We should. He should have his own book. I mean, in his time off from the game, he should just...
Who needs Eric Cantona?
Exactly. Now, including friendlies, Spurs have played Liverpool a total of 168 times. But how many of them have they won?
Sorry, 100 then?
168 games. I think there's only two friendlies in there or something.
100?
What? 33.
33?
45.
45 from Rick?
The delusion manoeuvre.
Well, you have to go back to the 60s, right?
I mean, you have to remember that Liverpool are actually a fairly successful club. There's a clue in there, right?
88.
Five European
clubs.
Rick was pretty close. 49. Their stats are played 168. This is Spurs' stats. 149, drawn 41, lost 78. Now,
close.
Spurs and Liverpool are two of only seven ever-present clubs since the Premiership inception. Can you name the other five? So Spurs and Liverpool.
Everton.
Man United.
Manchester United.
Arsenal. Newton. Newcastle.
No, since the Premiership.
Oh, sorry.
Arsenal,
two left.
Villa,
yep. Can't believe you boys. I'll have to put you out of your misery. The mighty Blues, Chelsea.
Okay,
from the Premiership.
Sorry, I was only looking at the top of the Premiership.
Now, Liverpool have only beaten Spurs once in the League Cup in whatever format it was. They've played each other seven times. But the time that Liverpool beat Spurs was the 1982 final. Can you tell me the score? I'm looking at William here. So Liverpool won. It was after extra time.
3-2?
It was 3-1. Now, can you tell me the scorers that day? Who scored for Spurs?
1982.
Yep.
Clive Allen.
Stevie Archibald. And for Liverpool? Someone got two?
Rush.
Rush got one. He was... Someone else got two. Not the guy you'd probably expect.
Moldy.
Very close. Think it's of the same Moldy type.
Not.
Same, no, the same type of player.
Soonest.
Defensive midfielder that didn't run around.
Oh, Craig Johnson.
Ronnie Whelan. Now, conversely, Spurs have only beaten Liverpool once in the FA Cup despite playing seven times. Now, that was in March 1995. It was the sixth round at Anfield.
I know this one.
Score and scorers.
I know this one. Klinsmann.
Klinsmann got one. And then one of the best FA Cup goals I've seen. The other one.
Ronnie Radford?
Nope. Remember?
I remember Klinsmann.
His strike partner.
Sheringham.
Remember that one? He just opened up his body and bent it into the top corner? Mm. Great one. And for Liverpool? Another great centre forward.
Owen.
Robbie Fowler. Now, we've got Manchester United Everton. Which Manchester United player disgracefully and shamefully has once a blue, always a blue tattooed on his arm?
Rooney.
Yeah, not really a difficult one. I just wanted to just out him. Now, Andrei Kanchelskis is famously agitated for a move to Everton from United. I'm still not quite sure why. But anyway, after he moved on from Everton, who did he sign for?
Rangers.
Nope.
Oh.
It was a club in between where he got a serious injury, unfortunately.
Blackburn?
Italy.
Roma.
Linked up, yeah, Roma. Oh, no, sorry, not Roma, sorry, because that was the guy's next club. I was going to say he linked up with Gabriel Batistuta.
Sampdoria.
Nope. Where did Batistuta make his name? There's a statue of him outside the ground.
Oh, jeez.
La Viola. Fiorentina.
Yes.
I was thinking, sorry, because you confused me, because he went on and won the league with Roma, did Batistuta. Now, April 2012, United drew 4-4 with Everton at Old Trafford. Can you name me the scorers on each side? And on each team, there's one player that got two.
This is the game that stopped us winning the league, wasn't
it? Yeah, mm-hmm. It was Fellaini.
Fellaini got one for Everton, yep. Yeah.
Who's the left back, whatever his name was.
Baines.
Wasn't Leighton Baines.
No, Baines, the other one. He's now moving on. Johnson.
Nope.
Was it? No.
So Fellaini got one. An Everton striker got two.
Naismith.
Now plays for...
Arteta?
I think he now... Has he gone to West Ham? I think he's gone to West Ham now. He was at Hull.
Oh. That, Jelovic.
Jelovic. Jelovic. And the other goal scorer for Everton? Joined Spurs briefly.
Maybe erase this from my memory in this game.
Stephen Pienaar. Come on. Who scored the goals for Manchester United? Someone got two? You can at least guess.
It's got to be Rooney.
Rooney, yep. And there's a centre forward that scores about one goal every 50 games.
That'd be Ryan Giggs.
No, centre forward.
Okay.
Berbatov.
England regular.
Danny Welbeck.
And the last one, Michael Jackson lookalike.
Nanny.
Yeah. Now, how many managers have managed both Sunderland and Newcastle?
One.
Sam. Big Sam. Yeah. And now, what was the last time that Holland missed out on a major tournament?
1984.
Nope. 1994. Nope. They've actually got a pretty poor quad. Considering they've been to three World Cup finals, won the European Championships, they've actually got a pretty poor record.
I know, is that not qualified for the Euros? For Euro Champions.
Did they not make the World Cup?
World Cup?
Yep. 2002. Yeah,
Korea, Japan.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Okay, so that takes us to the end of today's show. I'm your host, Steve McBain. A big thanks to Mr. William Howe.
Welcome.
Mr. Ryan Marsden.
Thank you.
And Mr. Rick Overton. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.